Welcome everyone back from the bank holidays. Today is another lecture for compiler construction. Last time we have talked about an algorithm for doing top-down syntax analysis, which means that what we essentially did was starting from the root symbol of our grammar, we were starting to try to derive the yield of such a symbol and tried to match that with the actual input that we found. And because that was a highly non-deterministic algorithm, what we did was we got ourselves advice for how to perform certain derivations, which meant that we gave ourselves a small look-ahead window into the input. And with this information, we were computing advice which derivation to take in case that there is multiple ways of doing a derivation. That was essentially what we did last time. Is there any question concerning that? No, because I think next lecture we will come back to a few of these concepts, especially to the computation of the first sets. So should probably try to memorize that in advance to next lecture. Anyway, what we are going to do today is we will have a look at how bottom-up analysis is performed. But before we start on that, let's have a look at why we would have a look at another kind of parsing algorithm at all. Because, well, we have already found a kind of working algorithm for many purposes. But of course, what we have already seen last time is that there's certain examples of grammars and inputs for which there is no way of specifying a general top-down parsing algorithm with through LL parsing with a certain fixed amount of look ahead into the input. So let's once again look at it a little bit more in a general way. There's a certain type of grammars for which it is not possible to compute any LLK parser at all. And yeah, let's delve deeper into which of these grammars actually don't work for LLK parsing. And essentially, that's not all of the grammars, but at least an example which is pretty easy to see. This is left recursive grammars. What is a left recursive grammar? In a left recursive grammar, you can create a sequence of derivations that follow your grammar rules, such that you can generate a sentence form, meaning a sequence of symbols, from a particular non-terminal. In this case, it's this A symbol. And the sequence that you can create from that, following just grammar rules, is a sentence form where you have the same non-terminal on the very left of the sentence form, so that the same symbol appears right in front of what you are generating. And that is this type of recursion that we call left recursive derivations now. And there's a property that certain grammars have. And it is not as seldom as one might think at the moment. So for an example, that is a grammar that I have also given you on the whiteboard over there, because we will have another example later on which uses this kind of grammar, and it's important to have the numbers on there, so that's why I've drawn it over there. Anyway, why is it left recursive? Well, I think that's pretty obvious to see. What we have to look for is sequences of productions or derivations that come up with a sentence form that has the same non-terminal with which we began. In these cases, it's pretty trivial. We have one over here for which we only need one derivation to get the same non-terminal in front. Also, this one here. So there's also, already two variants to generate recursive, left recursive sentence for or combinations of derivations. Okay, so why is this so drastic for us? Well, those this type of grammar is never LLK for any amount of look ahead window that you might set up in before you run the algorithm. So if you use a fixed size for the of look ahead, you will always be able to run out of look ahead before you will be able to decide on which of the productions can actually be or should actually be chosen. We can prove that in a generic way. So for the sake of simplicity, let's assume that we can do these, we have these left recursive steps in derivations in one step, but we could also do the same thing for several steps. And let's also assume that the non-terminal A is actually reachable from S, otherwise that's just a part of the grammar which is superfluous and can be thrown away. So we would like to reason about something meaningful, so we make A reachable from the start symbol. So let's assume for a moment that G is actually parsable with an LLK parser. What is the condition that this is actually something? What is the condition for the grammar that it is actually able to be parsed with LLK? Well, that has to do with the certain property of what you can derive from your symbols and what the actual first K symbols of the yield of this these sentence forms actually are in detail. What we need to make sure is that for all the different possibilities in which we might have to choose between different variations of our productions, we actually don't have an overlap between the first set of one variant with the first set of another variant. And in our case, we can find, for example, two sentence forms with this alpha, beta n, gamma, and also alpha, beta n plus 1, and gamma, which are actually sentence forms that can be derived from an A. How can they be derived? Well, you start from an S, you go down some derivations until you reach an A and probably something to the left and to the right. And from this A, you will then step by step generate betas and other A's, other betas, other A's, until at some point you will go the other alternative where you have the alpha. And there's also a kind of right context which comes from whatever has been preceding the A, which will then contribute to a gamma. And that is what these sentence forms actually are and how they are created. So the necessary condition for G to be LLK parsable is that if you take the first k symbols of the yield of these sentence forms, you need them to be non-overlapping. So they need to be distinct. Otherwise, for a certain occurring look ahead, you cannot decide which of these alternatives actually might be. So that is something that we need to have. So if you have a look at these derivation trees that belong to this kind of sentence forms, we'll have something like this. So there will be, this is the derivation tree for the first sentence form, and this is the one for the second sentence form. So far, so good. Can anyone already imagine what the problem might be in this kind of setup? Yes, please. So that is exactly the strategy that we are going for with this proof. The idea is for an LLK algorithm is that you have to fix a number of look-ahead symbols that you're going to look at. So you will fix the K for this first. And now the strategy is to use an input that needed a quite large number of these recursive productions or derivations in this case, and if we choose, we have to deal with a fixed k for the look ahead, but we can use arbitrary length inputs, and we can choose an input that will need the derivations here to be so numberful that with a limited k, we won't be able to get the hang of the whole yield that is actually produced by this large number of this large number of recursive A productions that we have applied for this input. So in this situation here, we so to say flood this look ahead window with these better symbols, such that we won't be able to detect the spot where these better symbols actually end and go over to the gamma thing. So if you compare these two, here, if you use a large number of these recursive productions, in this case, you it depends on the actual amount of symbols that is inside of that this beta consists of. But if we take one as the minimal number there, then we will just have to use derivations with the first variant in order to already reach the bound where we cannot differentiate anymore, whether we have to once again derive one time with this production, or whether we have to go over to the terminating sequence. So we can make use of that in order to reason about that this property that the grammar is LLK is actually not valid. We have two cases. In the first case, when we have a beta that is actually non-existent, which is just an empty string, if we have that situation, then, the sentence forms will actually collapse into the same, which is alpha gamma and alpha gamma, if beta is just non-existent. In this case, we cannot differentiate, and it doesn't matter which size of look-ahead window we choose. So in the case that beta is actually just empty, we won't be able to differentiate anymore, so that's it's a contradiction here. And for the other case, where beta is not the empty string, we will have some kind of word, and for that we will only have to choose k many derivations in order to reach a state where we cannot differentiate between whether we have to expand or whether with one variant or the other. So in both cases, we cannot differentiate anymore. We have overlapping, or in this case, even identical first sets for. We cannot decide anymore with our fixed input window which of the productions we have to expand. So that is the problem with left recursive grammars. Of course, there are certain techniques for getting rid of left recursion, but it is this manipulates your grammars a lot, and it's actually pretty tedious to apply these techniques in a larger real-life grammars. So, yeah, one would have to fiddle with automatic grammar rewriting, and as you will see later on, we will have other things that we will carry along with certain productions that also would have to be manipulated, and that's quite a complicated thing, so it's not always practical to perform these transformations. Okay, anyway, what this lecture today should be about is another alternative for top-down parsing, which is bottom-up parsing. And the idea is that in this case we the problem that we ran into before was that we had to decide on which production is actually expanded before we even had a proper look at the input. We did a lot of decisions that were concerning yield that was far ahead in compared to the place where we actually are at the moment when we want to parse. So the idea would be to kind of delay this decision whether we have to expand this or that until we have seen the complete input which belongs to the yield of the expansion in question. So that is the special parsing idea that was that Donald Knuth is actually known for, and that is this shift-reduce parser or shift-reduce parsing. And the basic idea is to successively shift input symbols onto the stack until we see a complete right-hand side of one of our productions on the stack, and then kind of apply this expansion in reverse, which we will then call a reduction, to transform the right-hand side of such a production or rule into its left-hand side, thus reducing the size of the thing that is still on the stack. And by recursively applying these two concepts of pushing onto the stack and reducing content that we find on the stack, the idea is to iteratively continue until we can produce the root symbol on the stack while we have cleared away all the input by shifting it onto the stack. So that is the general idea. How does that look in practice? So shift-reduce parser, for the example that we've seen in last lecture, would look like that. We have components that are look a little bit similar. We have states for this push down automaton. That is a start state, it's a final state. There's terminal symbols and there's non-terminal symbols. And what's actually happening is the following. we have the table for the transition relation here. So for a start, what we do is this, when we have the start state and we see an A, we will shift it over to onto the stack. There's also another shift, which you can see here. This will be applied in the case where we have an A on the stack and a B in the input. In this case, we will just put the B on top of that. Then there's other kinds of transitions where we actually transform what we find on the stack. Here is, for example, one where we transform the terminal A into the non-terminal A, which is just the rule over here, read in reverse. So we take the thing that we found on the stack, which is the concrete terminal, and we turn it into the non-terminal according to the rule above. Same thing goes for the B. So we introduce rules that do the reverse thing. What we also said is that our goal is to kind of process the stack to make it smaller in some way. And the place where we do that is, for example, here, where we actually tighten the stack a little bit more by removing A and B and replacing it with S. We do so according to the rule that we find above. And this kind of makes the stack more more compact again. And, of course, there's a kind of a generic rule that that tells us that we have finished parsing. It's the one where we go over from the start state with the S into the final state. Yeah, so that is a typical shift-reduce parser. Let's have a look at what the design principles for that is. That a shift-reduce parser can be directly generated from the grammar. We introduce shift transitions for and reduce transition and one transition for the actual finishing transition. So the finishing transition is always the same. This takes the root and the start state and makes it into a final state. So that is always the same. We can always write that into our transition list. Then we have reduced transitions. These ones. How do we come to them? Well, what we have to do is we have to create for every production that we find in our list of productions that belongs to our grammar, we implement the kind of reduction, meaning that we replace the right-hand side with the left-hand side, and that results in this kind of transition where we take the right-hand side and replace it with a left-hand side. We do that for any state which we find. And the other thing that we generate is shift transitions. Shift transitions also are applied to every state which we find on top of stack. And the ones that we have to add are for each of the terminal symbols. We just transfer them to the top of the stack by consuming them. Reduces and finishing moves are ones that actually don't touch the input in any way. Yeah. So let's see how such a shift-reduce parser works on an example. So let's have a look at the example computation. For our grammar, we only have one valid input, so it's easy to choose the example here. So what is rules that we can apply? Well, we are in the start state, but state doesn't matter in any way for the shift reduced parser. We have the input AB, and what can we do in this situation? Well, we cannot do any reductions because there's no right-hand sides of productions on the stack. So the only thing that we can do is we can take away input and put it onto the stack. Fine. Now that we have an A on the stack, what we can do is we can go along, take this, and replace it with the left-hand side of the according rule. And if you, well, since our grammar is pretty simple, we all remember that we end up with a large A here. For that, there's no rule that actually applies. So what we continue with now is the B here. This B is something that we shift onto the stack, which will write B on there. And we have consumed our complete input. And with a B on top of stack, we can once again do a reduction. The simple ones that we have is that we replace little b with large b, with a non-terminal b. And now we have the situation that there's once again a right-hand side of a production on the stack. So we will end up with this one, which is exactly our finishing transition, and we end up with an empty input and the final state on the stack. So that's how a shift-reduce parser works. Well, pretty simple, one might say. Is there any problem that you see for that kind of approach? Yes. So you say that we bought ourselves into non-determinism because we made everything dependent on the right-hand side of these things. Yes, that is actually one of the aspects that is wrong with, well, not exactly wrong, but problematic with this kind of approach. But there's even a simpler one. Well, depends on, but. There's one that you can also see here. I was probably playing the fool here and was fiddling around with letters, so probably you were not quick enough to see or to spot it. Well, one might wonder, for example, for this computational step, would you also have done that? Why did I exactly replace this thing? Why didn't I just shift the B over there and leave the A there? Well, that was, of course, I knew that I would like this sequence of computations to reach a final state. Without doing so, I wouldn't actually have reached it. But that's actually a point which makes you wonder whether the whole thing is actually deterministic, and actually it isn't. These two the conditions under which I do my transitions are actually not unique. You can do both of them. So there's a non-determinism clearly involved in the whole thing. It might have been a good idea to shift the B instead, because who knows when there would have been another rule, perhaps, that would have little a and little b on the right-hand side. That would have been a completely valid decision. But with just the transitions that we have here, that's not determined at all. You can use both of them. Plus, you can have several transitions that have the same right-hand side. So the whole idea is pretty much a good thing, as long as you're fine with just a non-deterministic parser. But that's something that we want to get rid of. We want to have something deterministic in order to implement. That's the same thing as we had for our LL algorithm. So, what could we do? There's a little bit of more of these observations. The one thing that I was leading you to is something that we have here that says that the general shift-reduce pushdown automaton is something which is clearly non-deterministic. Other things that we might have observed is that the actual sequence of reductions that we have applied in order to reach our goal have been ones that were exactly matching this concept of reverse rightmost derivations. That's why we had them back then when we were talking about these derivations. So, and you should keep in mind that the sequence of derivations that we find while parsing is actually something each of these detected reductions, or in the case of L parsing, these expansions, are always points where these parser components trigger user code to be executed. So this this sequence of expansions or derivations is actually kind of the semantics what our parser is actually doing here. So yeah, the parser that we constructed with the shift-reduce parser is actually one that has reversed rightmost derivations as sequences of derivations. Yeah, if you're interested in correctness of the whole thing, in this case, what you would have to do is to relate actual derivations of symbols with what the computational steps of our shift-reduce parser would actually do. So you would feed the words that are actually derivable from a certain non-terminal into the to the input of such a shift-reduce parser, and then try to prove, kind of by induction or something, that you would actually be able to derive A as being the root node for something that generates this word W, and also you would consume this word W with this sequence. Okay, so still, what the general message of this part should have been is that we still need to do something in order to come up with a deterministic algorithm here, and that leads to the field of LR parsing. So, what's LR parsing about? Well, in order to come up with a solution for this non-determinism, we look once again at what is actually happening at runtime on our pushdown and compare that with the state of our actual parser, and meaning we take the input and the pushdown at the same, and then we also look at the visualization of which part of the derivation tree is currently the one that is relevant to this part or to this state of our computation. So, yeah, let's have a look at an example. For this, I have given you the grammar together with the numbers because that's what you find inside the boxes of the derivation tree. So this E1 would correspond to the derivation E and goes to T, which is the E1 in this case. Okay. So, at the beginning, we start with the input counter times 2 plus 40, which is quite obviously a valid input to our arithmetical expressions. And the corresponding derivation tree is the one that you see on the right. So let's have a look at how our pushdown automaton would actually work. If it would work correctly, then it would produce that kind of these kind of states we see or that we will see on the following animation. So we start with the start state Q0 on the push down. And the input we have at first a counter, which is, well, a name. So that is the first thing that is going to have to be done. We will have to push the name on the push down, diminishing the input. Next thing that is going to happen is, well, what you can see on in the derivation tree is that we will have to do it first a reduction. So that's what is happening here. We will reduce to F, thereby consuming the name. Then with that, the next thing that's going to happen is we will once again reduce. So that's what we're going to do here. So it's the T that is going to be produced there. So next thing that has to happen in our shift-reduce parser in order to be successful is that at some point we will have to go up to T. But in order to do so, we still need other components, this one and this one. So what we're going to do is that we will shift the times operator over onto our push down and the 2, which will be turned into an int from the scanner. Now, what's going to have to happen is the int is at the on top of the stack, but before we can go over to our T, this will have to be converted to an F. So that's what's going to happen here. Now, what I will find on my stack is T times F. So these symbols here. And these are actually one of the right-hand sides of our productions. So we'll go over to the left-hand side. Once again, there's just one possibility that we want to have. So for this case, we will just replace it with an E. Now we are eager to go over to the topmost E, but for that we also need other things. So we continue as we have before until we reach the end. So if we have the correct derivation tree, we can pretty much decide what we want to do. So that is something that is pretty much a good thing. What we in general observe is that the decision what we actually want to do with our top of the stack is somehow dependent on what such a derivation tree actually looks like. This is actually something that is influenced by what is or has been happening in the past while this derivation tree kind of was expanding at some point. During these expansions, we had several situations where we modified the stack. And at some point, for example, here, where we replaced the F with the T, there was also a little bit of rest that was still on the push down. And this kind of rest is at some place some kind of evidence on what has been already reduced in the past. And that is also something that is kind of giving us evidence on where we consider our parsing state to be with respect to the derivation tree. So, in general, what we can observe is that this part here is something that is determining what is actually happening with the top of the stack. So that is something that we consider as important. The prefix of the stack is actually something that is important for the top of the stack to be processed. So the idea would be that probably we can find some way of influence that the prefix has on the kind of actions that we are allowed to do when we try to process the top of the stack. So the idea is to whether we can find a way to relate certain prefixes to certain reductions. When we succeed in this, and we can find a criterion what we should do at a certain position in our computation steps here. So the idea would be to have a look at the at these viable prefixes, which is this complete prefix of the stack until we reach the top of the stack, and that is something that is kind of produced from, or that is generated from reductions beforehand. But these reductions are ones that only make sense when they fit to the derivation tree. And derivation tree is something that gives us kind of boundaries on what kind of reductions were actually ones that were leading to our final derivation tree. So the idea would be to have a look at what is actually possible to derive. And that is some kind of top-down look onto our problem. Because what we can actually derive contributes to the prefix of our stack. And with that in mind, we might be able to decide better what we want to, in this case, I did the arrow in the wrong way. This might help us to decide whether we have to reduce or whether we still have to wait for a few other input boxes to take these one in, altogether and reduce them together. So that would be the general idea. What we are after is a way that tells us for a certain stack prefix which of the reductions are actually applicable at that point, or whether there's no reduction at all. In general, what we would like to have is a thing that tells us what the admissible items for a certain pushdown prefix actually are. And this is a set of kind of of a set of items that are valid or admissible in this case for certain prefix. And the idea would be to come up with those. And a way to get these is to apply the another automaton, which is named the characteristic automaton, onto the pushdown, not the input of the shift reduce parser, but on the pushdown of the shift reduce parser. Let this automaton compute something with its internal states, with these. With this, the pushdown symbols as its input, and when this characteristic automaton has processed all the symbols from the pushdown of the shift reduce parser, then we have a look at the actual state of the characteristic automaton look at how they are made up from, and decide with the help of this, of these states whether we want to reduce or whether we want to shift. And that is something that can be achieved with this characteristic automaton. The characteristic automaton is the one that we will create by looking at the productions, but in this case with our top-down view. That is the one that I have announced that will be more important a little bit beforehand. So this characteristic automaton will have its view starting from the top, and it will try to trace along possible derivations and especially on the things that these derivations might leave on our pushdown. So in this case, for example, it would have to accept t times f, and accepting we would be something that we would translate into now do a reduce. Contrary to the example before, it would also, for example, here for this e plus f, it would also read the input and would have, this would correspond to having a look at these, this path in the derivation. Well, it's not a path in a tree because there's actually no edge over there, but it would kind of skid along this this tree in a certain way. In order to detect that at that point, it would be beneficial to do a reduction. How can we come to such a thing? Well, we would have to kind of imitate this way of going along the derivation tree, and we would have to generate these accepting states in each case where such a reduction would be fulfilled, which would be at this point, at this point, at this point, at this point, at this point. This would be states that we would have to mark as points that as states where we want to do reductions, which would be final states of our characteristic automaton. How can we come up with such an automaton? That is something that we can do purely with just our grammar as our foundation. How would that look like? Well, we are the states of the characteristic automaton would be items. That's something that we have seen on sometime another slide. We would start this automaton with items for all the variants of our productions that we have. So with all for all the rules, we start one of these sequences. So for no. Why is it strange? Yeah, so for this e goes to e plus t, we will start one of these sequences. T goes to tf, we will start one of these sequences. The f goes to the braces, something like that. Then we will also have e goes to t, which is this. T goes to f, which is this one. And f goes to int. This one. And one that we haven't mentioned is always the S, this artificial one. The S goes to E in this case. Yeah, this is the one that we start over here. And what we do with them is that we will put them into a chain where we read all the symbols that are occurring on their right-hand sides. So for the e goes to e plus t, we will consume an e, and then consider our item to have processed the e and to the bullet in there. Then we continue with processing with reading a plus, and then we do the marker over here. Then we continue with reading in t and do the marker over here. Why do we do that? These are the steps that correspond to going to the right in our derivations. So these are the things that navigate this characteristic automaton over there, which means that these are cases where our pushdown actually reflects a state where we have already processed input and already reduced a lot of the input, the one over there, and come up with our summarized versions of these derivations or reductions, which is just this E. That is the only thing that remains of the input that we have already processed. Also, the T is something, well, it's direct input, and the other T. So if we can go over here, then we consider the whole thing over there to be already parsed, for example. So these are the cases where we just do these simple chains in our characteristic automaton. Now, what we also see over here is that we have to somehow navigate to a spot where we start such a line of input. So we have to somehow navigate over here along the tree to the beginning of such a sequence. Same goes for here. We have to do these navigational steps. These are ones that we have not done so far, that we still need to do. So these are the red ones here. These are ones that, how do they come into existence? These are ones that are induced from such a state whenever we have a marker in front of a non-terminal. These are situations where from a top-down point of view, you could at some place expand somehow. So because for the generic automaton, we don't know whether we are in a state where we have to consume E or whether we have to go somewhat down to consume an E. We will then use a non-deterministic transition, which means that all these red ones are actually epsilon transitions. The thing to take away here is we have two kinds of transitions. Ones are the ones that actually do consume input. We can read them from our items by having a look at where the marker is. And these are happening no matter whether the marker is in front of a non-terminal, like here, or in front of a terminal, like here. In both cases, we would do these named transitions. The next kind of transitions that is happening in the characteristic automaton are the ones that are epsilon transitions. Those are the ones that only occur in situations where the marker is in front of a non-terminal. For each of them, I have to connect this item with the items that start with the corresponding non-terminal, like in this case, where we have the bullet in front of E, and then we have to connect with the items that have the E on the left-hand side. So this is the characteristic automaton. This is this kind of small pink arrow that we have seen that navigates to the points in derivation tree that actually corresponds to my current state of parsing. So this one is the one that we have to run on the viable prefix, which means on the stack or the push down of the shift reduce parser, and when the complete push down is parsed, is consumed by this automaton, then we can have a look at the state in which we end up with our automaton. So if we end up, for example, in this state here, the characteristic automaton would say this is a good spot for doing reductions, especially the reduction reducing this E to our start symbol S. If we read our input with the characteristic automaton and come up with a state like this, then the meaning would be, well, the marker is still not arrived at a point where it is on the very right of the rule, which means that the this item is not yet complete. In this case, the characteristic automaton tells us not to reduce, but instead do a shift because it's still not done with this part of the input. Yeah, so that is the characteristic automaton. Of course, there's a lot of epsilon transitions in there, and epsilon transitions are always things that are bad for us in a finite automaton, so the next thing would be to get rid of this, which means, of course, doing something like power set construction. And when we do something like this, we reach we transform this characteristic automaton in something different, which we call the canonical LR0 automaton. In our example, we can see what is actually happening there. That is the result of the power set construction on the thing that we have seen before. Yeah. So far, so good. Let's do this in practice. Instead of doing at first the characteristic automaton and then the power set construction, that is something that is pretty easy with our current knowledge. There's also the second possibility, which is a little bit faster if you think a little bit about what you do, which is a direct construction of the canonical LR0 automaton out of the pure grammar without intermediary steps like this very largish characteristic automaton and also the time-consuming power set construction in between. So that is the one that is actually used in practice. So this canonical LR0 automaton construction is one that we should look at. The basic idea is to, instead of just do this large automaton and then optimize, would be to create the generic the power set construction on the fly. And how would we do that? Well, the idea would be just to, for example, just start our thing. We'd start with the start state. Start state of the canonical LR0 automaton consists in several items. States of canonical and characteristic automata are always sets of items. Which one is definitely part of the whole thing? Well, that is the artificial start symbol. And for our grammar, we always start with E. So this one will be the first item that is in our state. But only having this thing is not enough, because as you remember, we have this this idea of connecting connecting particular items with other ones always then when the bullet or the marker is particularly in front of a non-terminal. In these cases, we use to connect other items with epsilon transitions. When we want to do the power set construction kind of in place, then we need to add these other items whenever we add an item that has a bullet in front of a non-terminal. So in this case, I would have to add all the variants that we have for productions that start on E. So I have to have to add these two. So that I do. Always remember, in this case we have items and not productions. So I have to put the bullet in front of here. So am I done yet? Well, I have added items that have the E on the left-hand side. But now we have added an item that has the marker in front of the T. So, yeah, there's yet another production or even set of productions that I have to add, which are this one and this one. So I add them. And now that we have already drawn a lot of them, there's kind of a bell already ringing each time that I place my marker in front of a new symbol. With that, I also have to add the F production. So I end up with the F production over here, and F goes to int. Am I done yet? Well, all I have to do in order to determine whether I'm done is I have to have a look at all the bullets that I've placed. So I have to look out. I have to look for productions with E, and I have added all the productions with E. Fine. Then there is the bullet in front of the T. I've added productions for T. Fine. There's a bullet in front of F, and I've added productions with F, fine. And then there's a bullet in front of this bracket. Well, bracket is a terminal, so I don't do an epsilon transition for this one, so this one doesn't need any further productions. And then there's a bullet in front of int. Int is also considered to be a terminal, so in this case, we're done. Fine. With the transition to the final state, which final state are you referring to? Because there's two automata involved right now. There's a shift-reduce automaton and there's the canonical automaton. For the canonical automaton, is same as the characteristic automaton, we have an automatic criterion when we consider a state to be a final state, which is when we move the bullet to the end of my right hand side, then we consider then that would be a final state. Mm-hmm. So this is still a very initial state, so to say. And that, of course, it is the initial state, this Q0. And for this grammar here, there's no empty production, so we don't need it to be somewhat final, but we will see other final states later on. So anyway, we can come up with other states by... We can create other ones by going along the transition of our automaton from Q1 together with, for example, well, what might be a good idea? Well, we could, for example, read a T. I would create other states of my canonical automaton by putting... Nobody saw it. Of course, I have to emanate from my start state, from the Q0, at least at the moment, in order to create new states. And I would... Which are the symbols that I take for my transitions? Well, I can be guided by the symbols that I find behind the markers. So for the first one, I used a T as a symbol, but I could also use, of course, an E or an F or even one of these brackets. So just to have... another thing, I can also have a transition under consuming such a bracket. So, but anyway, we need to fill in the states that will the items that will make up the state. So for this, I go back into my initial state and have a look at things that can happen whenever I read a T. So in these cases, the items that have The items that have the mark in front of E will probably ones that won't be relevant when I want to go from Q0 with T. So these are ones that will drop out of relevant items here. Then there's the one that will probably be something meaningful for our new Q1, which is because the marker is in front of the T. So I will take them into my new set of states. So I will have, in this case, E goes to T, and T goes to T times F. Where do I place the marker? Well, going through the automaton with the input like T means that I have to shift the marker by one. So I will place my marker here and here. The other ones are all are also ones that, so this one I took, these will also will all be ones that won't be relevant because they don't have the T after the marker. So with that, am I done yet? Are there any more items that I need to add here? That is something that you should always ask yourself when you have done such a transition, because you might end up with a situation where the bullet is once again in front of a non-terminal, and in this case you would reopen a lot of new items and place them under there. Luckily, in this case, there's nothing left right of the marker here, and there's only a terminal here, so we're actually done with this one. Yeah. And same thing is what we have to do for Q2, but this is pretty time-consuming, and I'm sure that we will have a few exercises of your own on the slides, so I've prepared the states for you. So these are ones that you... The first one is one that you have seen... No. That you have seen me constructing already. I think the T one was the second one that you've seen me doing. And then there's the E one, which is pretty similar to the one that we had before. The F one is also pretty similar. And the int one, yeah, it's just this one. At that point already you see that this is quite a lot of work, because that's going through the whole automaton manually, but that is something that can be automatically. Oh yes. No, there's no reason. That's a good finding. Yeah, that shouldn't be there. That should be a comma. And luckily that doesn't write on. But you're the first one in, I think, 8 years that has spotted this one. I'm pretty sure that this one has already been in 8 years before. Yeah. That's when I designed the things, but thank you. I also have to check, because I think I recycled this slide somewhere later on, and that's, keep an eye on that. Probably that will reappear once again in the future. Okay. Anyway, the most interesting one is one that I haven't done over here, which is this one, because with this one we will end up with a marker once again in front of the E, and you will see that this. This will not only lead to just the shifted marker, but the whole lot of productions that we have had for our initial state will reappear here in the tail of the state, And yeah, you see that there, this induces quite a lot of other transitions and states to emerge. So yeah, there's still a lot of work to do. And also for Q1, which seemed quite nice over here, whenever we consume a plus over here, we will have the marker in front of the T, which will then once again generate a whole lot of things. But if you continue with the whole thing and go over to the 11th state, you will realize that at one point the whole system stabilizes, and that the only states that you generate are ones that have already appeared before. Of course, this is quite a lengthy example, all in all. Nevertheless, that is something that is actually done in practical systems, and it's also something that is happening on paper, so that could be some kind of hint for exercises and other opportunities where we have to write things. Anyway, you don't have to be afraid, as you have limited time. We also have limited time for checking these things. We will try to limit the amount of work that you need to do by hand, so we will choose either smaller example, or we will give you a kind of nesting depth until you so that you can kind of abort this kind of construction at a certain point. But nevertheless, you should remember the parts that contribute to these kind of constructions. That means the steps that we had to had to do is, for example, coming up with the right initial state. That means that the first one, the first item that we have to add is always this artificial one. We can help ourselves a little bit more by just doing adding this thing into our grammars by default. We try to do so in our exercises and other occurrences of grammars, but yeah, this is something that will lead to this very first production. And from that, what you need to do is you need to trace the occurrences of the marker in front of a non-terminal in order to add new items, and then with that you continue by having a look at the possible transitions that can emanate from our state. You've seen that you can get an idea of what are feasible transitions by looking at the different non-terminals which are marked in our items, and yeah, that's the way to do these things. Also, this LR0 construction is kind of the foundation for another construction that we will do next time, so it would be a good idea to try to get the grasp on this one. Okay, more formally, what is it? What we do here is, well, we will construct an automaton. States for this automaton will, or this type of automata will be always sets of items. The start state is the one that we get by starting with our artificial S prime, goes to our root node or root symbol, as well as performing the epsilon closure. That is, epsilon closure is this delta star epsilon. That is something that we have done informally already on the slides before. That was this tracing of the bullet and whether it occurs in front of a non-terminal. More formally speaking, what we have done here is that performing the epsilon closure on a certain set of items works by checking for each of the productions, each of the items that are found inside our initial set of items, checking for non-terminals that are that are behind one of these bullets, which are marked by the bullet, and then trying to come up with all these the possible derivations that are doable from these kind of from these kind of non-terminals, and having a look at the symbols that occur in front of the derivable sentence forms. And with these symbols, we add new items to our item set that makes up this with this epsilon closure. That is just the formal way of doing the same thing that we have done on the slides before. So that is a thing that we will use certain times in our construction of this canonical LR0 automaton. The transitions, for example, also have an application of the epsilon closure. In general, always when we come up with new states, we will perform this epsilon closure on that. How do we come up with the initial set of items for these for the transition destinations? Well, what we do there is that we that whenever we do a transition, we have an origin state and a symbol. What we will do is we have a look at the origin state, and we look for items where the marker is in front of the consumed or the label of this transition, and from that we can create one of the items that will become the new become member of the new initial set of items for the new state. All we have to do now with these with this initial set is we have to apply the epsilon closure in order to come up with the new states. Final states are ones that have complete items in their set of items. So this is canonical LR0 automaton construction. With this thing, we can now start to combine it with a shift-reduced parser in order to create a hopefully deterministic parser, which we will then call the LR0 parser. The idea is that the shift-reduced parser runs as we have planned. It has a non-deterministic choice for shifting or reducing. It does whatever it pleases. But now, by combining it with the canonical LR0 automaton, we can get rid of the non-determinism by running the canonical LR0 automaton on the content of the pushdown, and by having a look at the state where the canonical LR0 automaton ends up with, we can identify reduction spots and also read off which reduction we want to take in order to reduce. There's also an idea for optimization of the whole process, because this seems a little bit tedious for every step of our shift-reduce parser to again read the whole contents of the pushdown. Instead, the idea would be, well, we already have our canonical automaton in a certain state at a certain point. And in order to analyze our state, when we do the next step in our shift reduce parser, we could just reuse the position where we already are in order to not having to read the whole push down once again. Because, well, that's something that we have already done with our canonical automaton. So instead of reading the pushdown automaton again and again for each step of the shift-reduce automaton, the idea would be not to put the symbols on the pushdown, but instead put the states that the canonical LR0 automaton has performed on the pushdown. That gives us the chance to kind of, whenever we have ended up in a state where the canonical automaton said reduce, then we can actually trigger a reduce action in our complete parser and then take away all the states that have been here contributing to such a final state. For example, when we end up in this thing, we can just take away from the pushdown this state, this state, this state, and this state, and then continue. Well, it's probably this one would have been the right one. So we could take away this one, this one, this one, and this one, and continue with reading from the state that then remains on the stack, which will probably be kind of, for example, this one or something. Well, it's probably not the best example that I've chosen here for this line. Yeah, but actually, this one would have been the one. And when we went along this thing here, for example, we could have taken away this, and this, and replaced it with the left-hand side of E plus and T, which is probably going once again into this state. So this is the kind of intuitive idea that is behind this optimization here. What is actually performed is... it's not directly shown here. This one is on the next box. Okay, so that is still something that we have to mention. And this one is on the problem that... I think, was it you? You were asking for the final states in this whole system. And this is the point that actually refers to that. We have said that we consider the states where the bullet is on the very right-hand side as the complete items, and this would be ones that were responsible for reducing. The problem is that this is a condition that is not always unique. So we might end up in our parser with states, for example, here are ones that I've mentioned before or that we've created before, and there's final states in there, for example, the states Q1, Q2, and Q9, but also Q3, Q4, Q10, and Q11. For this one, we are pretty much satisfied. It's just one complete item. We can say exactly which reduction this belongs to. Same goes for here and for these two. These are just fine as final states. However, there's also other states, for example, this Q1, where we have a completed item. But all the same, we might also consider our situation as in the middle of some other production. So the item is not completed here. So there's still room for non-determinism in LR0 parsers. However, there is LR0 parsers that actually are deterministic. I think you will have one of them on your exercise sheet. However, there is still room for non-determinism, which we will call conflicts, and we will, I think, treat them next time. Anyway, what LR0 parsers are all about was what we had on some slides before. That was that for an LR0 parser, we conceptually came from the shift-reduce parser and just added a canonical automaton in order to parse the push down. But in order to make them more efficient, the idea was not to analyze the whole push down anymore, but just keep the states of the canonical LR0 automaton on the push down. That's the concept that you see realized in this construction of the LR0 parser. What you do here is you have a canonical automaton, which is this little thing over there, which consists of several components. For example, or most prominently, this delta, which is the transition relation for the LR0 canonical automaton. And the whole LR0 parser is then organized around this canonical automaton. And what is actually done is for the states of the LR0 parser, you choose the final state and the states Q, which are actually the states of the canonical automaton. So what you do in the LR0 parser is you keep states of the canonical automaton on your push down. And how you do it is, what you do is you do, for example, these shift transitions, which do the following: whenever the transition function of the canonical automaton says consume a terminal symbol, then this will end up in a new state of the canonical automaton. And what the LR0 parser does then is it parses this input symbol and places the newly computed state of the canonical automaton on top of the last state, the one that we had before. So it kind of keeps track of the sequence of states that the canonical automaton has done. Then there's also situations where the topmost state of the canonical automaton that is found on the LR0's push down, there's a situation when this topmost state contains a complete item, that is this condition, and if it does so, what is actually done is we have a closer look at this completed item, and we see that it features m many many symbols on the right hand side. So these are in order for the symbol to be here, there must be m consecutive items still on the push down that do actually one-to-one correspond to positions of the bullet in items there. So I have to take them away and replace them with a new state that actually consists in state that's not the one, in the state before, which is this p, and I give this p into the transition function of the canonical automaton together with the left hand side of this item over here, and the new state that I get from that, which is this q, is the one that I place on top of the stack instead of all the intermediate states that represented the right hand side of the completed item. So that's why I have to get rid of all these. Okay, and then there's of course the finishing transition. This is the one where I find that the our artificial start production is a complete item, which is present in the top of stack state, and also our input is only epsilon anymore. So in this case, we go over to the finishing state. So that is how we can put together the canonical automaton together with the shift reduce concept to create this LR0 parser. Correctness is something, well, the LR0 parser is something that we created alongside the shift reduce parser. So this, we only have to prove that there's a one-to-one relation between these two. Yeah, apart from that, the only thing that remains is that with that we create a reverse rightmost derivation. Apart from that, all that we recognize is the accepted language of the grammar. But unfortunately, there's still non-determinism in there, which is actually called reduce-reduce conflicts or shift-reduce conflicts. We will have a look at how they look like in detail next time. Also, we are going to look at how we can come up with ways for getting rid of these conflicts. So I would advise you for next time to have to probably prepare what we have learned about the LR0, because what we do next time is an extension of this LR0 automaton, and it is more easily understandable if you have it freshly in your mind. So I would recommend you to read and probably also try out the exercises for LR0, because we will extend it next time to the next level. Okay, so apart from that, thank you very much for your attention, and I hope you have a nice week. See you all next time. Thank you.